Side 9. Christine. Continuing on page 331. You have to be ready to help yourself before anyone else can help you. Fuck that bullshit. They were rats deserting a sinking ship. Not one of them, from that shitter Slauson with his thick horn-rimmed glasses and his weird poached egg eyes, to his rotten shitting old man who was so fucking pussy-whipped that he ought to just give that cunt he was married to a razor and invite her to cut it off, to that cheap bitch in her fancy house with her legs crossed. Probably she'd been having her period, and that's why she choked on the goddamn hamburger. And those shitters with their fancy goddamn cars and the trunks full of golf clubs. Those goddamn officers, I'd like to bend them over this here lathe. I'd play some golf with them. I could find the right hole to put those little white balls in, you bet your ass. But when I get out of here, no one's going to tell me what to do. It's going to be my way, mine, 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 mine. Arnie came back to himself suddenly, scared and wide-eyed, breathing hard. What had been happening to him? He had seemed like someone else there for a moment. Someone on a crazed rant against humanity in general. Not just someone. It was LeBay. No, that's not true at all. Lee's voice. Isn't that the truth of it, Arnie? Suddenly something very like a vision rose in his tired, confused mind. He was hearing a minister's voice. Arnold, do you take this woman to be your loving? But it wasn't a church, it was a used car lot with bright multicolored plastic pennants fluttering in a stiff breeze. Camp chairs had been set up. It was Will Darnell's lot, and Will was standing beside him in the best man's position. There was no girl beside him. Christine was parked beside him, shining in a spring sun, even her white walls seeming to glow. His father's voice. Is there something going on? The preacher's voice. Who giveth this woman to this man? Roland E. LeBay rose from one of the camp chairs like the prow of a skeletal ghost ship from Hades. He was grinning. And for the first time, Arnie saw who had been sitting around him. Buddy Repperton? Richie Trelawney? Moochie Welch. Richie Trelawney was black and charred, most of his hair burned off. Blood had poured down Buddy Repperton's chin and had caked his shirt like hideous vomit. But Moochie Welch was the worst. Moochie Welch had been ripped open like a laundry bag. They were smiling. All of them were smiling. I do, Roland D. LeBay croaked. He grinned, and a tongue slimed with graveyard mold lolled from the stinking hole of his mouth. I give her, and he's got the receipt to prove it. She's all his. The bitch is the ace of spades, and she's all his. Arnie became aware that he was moaning in the telephone booth, clutching the receiver against his chest. With a tremendous effort, he pulled himself all the way out of the daze, vision, whatever it had been, and got hold of himself. This time, when he reached for the change on the ledge, he spilled half of it onto the floor. He plugged a dime into the slot and scrabbled through the telephone book until he found the hospital number. Dennis. Dennis would be there. Dennis always had been. Dennis wouldn't let him down. Dennis would help. The switchboard girl answered, and Arnie said, Room 240, please. The connection was made. The phone began to ring. It rang, and rang, and rang. Just as he was about to give up, a brisk female voice said, Second floor, C wing, who are you trying to reach? Gilder, Arnie said, Dennis Gilder. Mr. Gilder's in physical therapy right now, the female voice said. You could reach him at 8 o'clock. Arnie thought of telling her it was important, very important, but suddenly he was overwhelmed with a need to get out of the phone booth. Claustrophobia was like a giant's hand pushing down on his chest. He could smell his own sweat. The smell was sour, bitter. Sir? Yeah, okay, I'll call back, Arnie said. He broke the connection and nearly burst out of the booth, leaving his change scattered on the ledge and the floor. A few people turned around to look at him, mildly interested, and then turned back to their food again. Bates is ready, the counterman said. Arnie glanced up at the clock and saw he had been in the booth for almost 20 minutes. There was sweat all over his face. His armpits felt like a jungle. His legs were trembling. The muscles in his thighs felt as if they might simply give out and spill him onto the floor. He paid for the pizza, nearly dropping his wallet as he tucked his $3 in change back in. You okay? The counterman asked. You look a little whiter on the gills. I'm fine, Arnie said. Now he felt as if he might vomit. He snatched the pizza in its white box with the word Geno's emblazoned across the top and fled into the cold, sharp clarity of the night. The last of the clouds had blown away, and the stars twinkled like chipped diamonds. He stood on the sidewalk for a moment, looking first at the stars, and then at Christine, parked across the street, waiting faithfully.
She would never argue or complain, Arnie thought. She would never demand. You could enter her any time and rest on her plush upholstery, rest in her warmth. She would never deny. She loved him. Yes, he sensed that was true. Just as he sometimes sensed that LeBay would not have sold her to anyone else, not for 250, not for 2,000. She had been sitting there waiting for the right buyer, one who would love her for herself alone. That voice inside whispered, yes, that was it, that was exactly it. Arnie stood there with his pizza forgotten in his hands, white steam rising lazily from the grease-spotted box. He looked at Christine, and such a confusing whirl of emotions ran through him that there might have been a cyclone in his body, rearranging everything it did not simply destroy. Oh, he loved and loathed her. He hated her and cherished her. He needed her and needed to run from her. She was his, and he was hers, and I now pronounce you man and wife, joined and sealed from this day forth forever and ever until death do you part. But worst of all was the horror, the terrible, numbing horror, the realization that... How did you hurt your back that night, Arnie? After Repperton, the late Clarence, Buddy Repperton, and his buddies trashed her. How did you hurt your back so that now you have to wear the stinking brace all the time? How did you hurt your back? The answer rose, and Arnie began to run, trying to beat the realization, to get to Christine before he saw the whole thing plain and went mad. He ran for Christine, running his tangled emotions and some terrible dawning realization a foot race. He ran to her the way a hype runs for his works when the shakes and the jitters get so bad he can no longer think of anything but relief. He ran the way that the damned run to their appointed doom. He ran as a bridegroom runs to the place where his bride stands waiting. He ran because inside Christine, none of these things mattered. Not his mother, father, Lee, Dennis, or what he had done to his back that night when everyone was gone. That night after he had taken his almost totally destroyed Plymouth from the airport and back to Darnell's, and after the place was empty, he had put Christine's transmission in neutral and pushed her until she began to roll on her flat tires, pushed her until she was out the door and he could hear the wind of November keening sharply around the wrecks and the abandoned hulks with their stellated glass and their ruptured gas tanks. He had pushed her until the sweat ran off him in rivers and his heart thudded like a runaway horse in his chest and his back cried out for mercy. He had pushed her, his body pumping as if in some hellish consummation. He had pushed her, and inside, the odometer ran slowly backward. And some 50 feet beyond the door, his back began to really throb, and he kept pushing. And then his back began to scream in protest, and he kept pushing, muscling it along on the flat, slashed tires, his hands going numb, his back screaming, screaming, screaming. And then he reached Christine and flung himself inside, shuddering and panting. His pizza fell on the floor. He picked it up and set it on the seat, feeling calm slowly wash through him like a soothing balm. He touched the steering wheel, let his hand slip down it, tracing its delicious curve. He took one glove off and felt in his pocket for his keys, for LeBay's keys. He could still remember what had happened that night, but it did not seem horrible now. Now, sitting behind Christine's steering wheel, it seemed rather wonderful. It had been a miracle. He remembered how it had suddenly become easier to push the car because the tires were healing themselves magically, kneading themselves together without a scar, and then inflating. The broken glass had begun to reassemble from nowhere, knitting itself upward with small, scratchy, crystalline sounds. The dents began to pop back out. He simply pushed her until she was right enough to run. And then he had driven her, cruising between the rows, until the odometer ran back past what Repperton and his friends had done. And then Christine was okay. What could be so horrible about that? Nothing, the voice said. He looked around. Roland D. LeBay was sitting on the passenger side of the car, wearing a black double-breasted suit, a white shirt, a blue tie. A row of medals hung askew on one lapel of his suit coat. It was the outfit he had been buried in. Arnie knew that, even though he had never actually seen it. Only LeBay looked younger and tougher, a man you'd not want to fool with. "Start her up," LeBay said. "Get the heater going and let's motivate." "Sure," Arnie said, and turned the key. Christine pulled out, tires crunching on the packed snow. He had pushed her that night until almost all the damage had been repaired. No, not repaired, negated. Negated was the right word for what had happened. And then he had put her back in stall 20, leaving the rest to do himself. "Let's have us some music," the voice beside him said. Arnie turned on the radio. Dion was singing Donna the Prima Donna. "You going to eat that pizza or what?" The voice seemed to be changing somehow. "Sure," Arnie said. "You want a piece?" Leering, "I never say no to a piece of anything." Arnie opened the pizza box with one hand and pulled a piece free. "Here you go." His eyes widened. The slice of pizza began to tremble, the long threads of cheese dangling down, beginning to sway like the strands of a spider web broken by the wind. It wasn't the bear sitting there anymore. It was him. It was Arnie Cunningham, at roughly age 50. Not as old as LeBay had been when he and Dennis first met him on that August day. Not that old, but getting there, friends and neighbors, getting there. His older self was wearing a slightly yellowed T-shirt and dirty oil-smeared blue jeans. The glasses were horn-rims taped at one bow. The hair was cut short and receding. The gray eyes were muddy and bloodshot. The mouth had taken all the tucks of sour loneliness, because this thing, apparition, whatever it was alone. He felt that. Alone except for Christine. This version of himself and Roland D. LeBay could have been son and father. The resemblance was that great. "You going to drive or are you going to stare at me?" this thing asked, and it suddenly began to age before Arnie's stunned eyes. The iron-colored hair went white. The T-shirt rippled and thinned, the body beneath twisted with age. The wrinkles raced across the face and then sank in like lines of acid. The eyes sank into their sockets and the corneas yellowed. Now only the nose thrust forward, and it was the face of some ancient carrion eater, but still his face, oh yes, still his. "See anything green?" this octogenarian Arnie Cunningham croaked, as its body twisted and writhed and withered on Christine's red seat. "See anything green? See anything green? See anything?" The voice cracked and rose and whined into a shrill, senile treble. And now the skin broke open in sores and surface tumors, and behind the glasses, milky cataracts covered both eyes like shades being pulled down. It was rotting before his very eyes, and the smell of it was what he had smelled in Christine before. What Lee had smelled, only it was worse now. It was the high, gassy, gagging smell of high-speed decay, the smell of his own death. And Arnie began to whine as Little Richard came on the radio singing Tutti Frutti, and now the thing's hair was falling out in gossamer white drifts, and its collarbones poked through the shiny, stretched skin above the T-shirt's sagging round collar. They poked through like grotesque white tinsels. Its lips were shriveling away from the final surviving teeth that leaned this way and that like tombstones. It was him. It was dead, and yet it lived. Like Christine. It lived.
"See anything green?" it gibbered. "See anything green?"
Arnie began to scream. 39. Junkins again. The fenders were clicking the guardrail posts. The guys beside me were just as white as ghosts. One says, "Slow down, I see spots. The lines in the road look just like dots." Charlie Ryan. Arnie pulled into Darnell's garage about an hour later. His rider, if there really had been a rider, was long gone. The smell was gone, too. It had undoubtedly been just an illusion. If you hung around the shitters for long enough, Arnie reasoned, everything started to smell like shit. And that made them happy, of course. Will was sitting behind his desk in his glassed-in office, eating a hoagie. He raised one drippy hand, but didn't come out. Arnie blipped his horn and parked. It had all been some kind of dream, simple as that. Some crazy kind of dream. Calling home, calling Lee, trying to call Dennis, and having that nurse tell him Dennis was in physical therapy. It was like being denied three times before the cock crew or something. He had freaked a little bit. Anyone would have freaked after the shitstorm he'd been through since August. It was all a question of perspective, after all, wasn't it? All his life he had been one thing to people, and now he was coming out of his shell, turning into a normal everyday person with normal everyday concerns. It was not at all surprising that people should resent this, because when someone changed, for better or worse, for richer or poorer,
It was natural for people to get a little weird about it. It fucked up their perspective. Lee had spoken as if she thought he was crazy. And that was nothing but bullshit of the purest ray serene. He had been under strain, of course he had, but strain was a natural part of life. If Miss High Box Oh-So-Preppy Lee Cabot thought otherwise, she was in for an abysmal fucking at the hands of that all-time champion rapist, Life. She'd probably end up taking Dexies to get out of first gear in the morning and Nembys or Ludes to come down at night. Ah, but he wanted her. Even now, thinking about her, he felt a great, unaccountable, unnameable desire sweep through him like cold wind, making him squeeze Christine's wheel fiercely in his hands. It was a hot wanting, too great, too elemental for naming. It was its own force. But he was all right now. He felt he had crossed the last bridge or something. He had come back to himself, sitting in the middle of a narrow access road beyond the farthest parking lot reaches of the Monroeville Mall, which meant he was roughly halfway to California. Getting out, looking behind the car, he had seen a hole smashed through a snowbank, and there was melting snow sprayed across Christine's hood. Apparently, he had lost control, gone skating across the lot, which, even with the Christmas shopping season in full swing, was mercifully empty this far out, and had crashed through the bank. Damn lucky he hadn't been in an accident. Damn lucky. He had sat there for a while, listening to the radio and looking through the windshield of a half-moon floating overhead. Bobby Helms had come on singing Jingle Bell Rock, a sound of the season, as the DJ said, and he had smiled a little, feeling better. He couldn't remember what exactly it was that he had seen, or thought he had seen, and he didn't really want to. Whatever it had been, it was the first and last time, he was quite sure of that. People had gotten him imagining things. They'd probably be delighted if they knew, but he wasn't going to give them that satisfaction. Things were going to be better all the way around. He would mend his fences at home. In fact, he could start tonight by watching some TV with his folks, just like in the old days. And he would win Lee back. If she didn't like the car, no matter how weird her reasons were, fine. Maybe he would even buy another car sometime soon and tell her he had traded Christine in. He could keep Christine here, rent space. What she didn't know wouldn't hurt her. And Will. This was going to be his last run for Will this coming weekend. That bullshit had gone just about far enough. He could feel it. Let Will think he was a chicken, if that's what he wanted to think. A felony rap for interstate transport of unlicensed cigarettes and alcohol wouldn't look all that hot on his college application, would it? A federal felony rap? No, not too cool. He laughed a little. He did feel better. Purged. On his way over to the garage, he ate his pizza, even though it was cold. He was ravenous. Yet it struck him a bit peculiar that one piece was gone. In fact, it made him a bit uneasy, but he dismissed it. He had probably eaten it during that strange blank period, or maybe even thrown it out the window. Whew, that'd have been spooky. No more of that shit. And he laughed again, this time a little less shakily. Now he got out of the car, slammed the door, and started toward Will's office to find out what he had for him to do this evening. It suddenly occurred to him that tomorrow was the last day of school before the Christmas vacation, and that put an extra spring in his step. That was when the side door, the one beside the big carport door, opened, and a man let himself in. It was Junkins, again. He saw Arnie looking at him and raised a hand. Hi, Arnie. Arnie glanced at Will. Through the glass, Will shrugged and went on eating his hoagie. Hello, Arnie said. What can I do for you? Well, I don't know, Junkins said. He smiled, and then his eyes slid past Arnie to Christine, appraising, looking for damage. Did you want to do something for me? Not fucking likely, Arnie said. He could feel his head starting to throb with rage again. Rudy Junkins smiled, apparently unoffended. I just dropped by. How you been? He stuck out his hand. Arnie only looked at it. Not embarrassed in the slightest, Junkins dropped his hand, walked around to Christine, and began examining her again. Arnie watched him, his lips pressed together so tightly they were white. He felt a fresh pulse of anger each time Junkins dropped one of his hands onto Christine. Look, maybe you ought to buy a season ticket or something, Arnie said. Like to the Steelers games. Junkins turned and looked at him questioningly. Never mind, Arnie said sullenly. Junkins went on looking. You know, he said, it's a hell of a strange thing what happened to Buddy Rapperton and those other two boys, isn't it? Fuck it, Arnie thought. I'm not going to fool around with this shitter. I was in Philadelphia, chess tourney. I know, Junkins said. Jesus, you're really checking me out. Junkins walked back to Arnie. There was no smile on his face now. Yes, that's right, he said. I'm checking you out. Three of the boys I believe were involved in vandalizing your car are now dead, along with a fourth boy who was apparently just along for the ride on Tuesday night. That's a pretty big coincidence. It's 9 miles too big for me. You bet I'm checking you out. Arnie stared at him, surprised out of his anger, uncertain. I thought it was an accident, that they were liquored up and speeding, and there was another car involved, Junkins said. How do you know that? There were tracks in the snow, for one thing. Unfortunately, the wind had blurred them too much for us to be able to get a decent photo, but one of the barriers at the Squantic Hill State Park gate was broken, and we found traces of red paint on it. Buddy's Camaro wasn't red. It was blue. He measured Arnie with his eyes. We also found traces of red paint embedded in Moochie Welch's skin, Arnie. Can you dig that? Embedded. Do you know how hard a car has to hit a guy to embed paint in his skin? You ought to go out there and start counting red cars, Arnie said coldly. You'll be up to 20 before you get to Basin Drive, I guarantee it. You bet, Junkins said. But we sent our samples to the FBI lab in Washington, where they have samples of every shade of paint they ever used in Detroit. We got the results back today. Any idea what they were? Want to guess? Arnie's heart was thudding dully in his chest. There was a corresponding beat at his temples. Since you're here, I'd guess it was autumn red, Christine's color. Give that man a Cupid doll, Junkins said. He lit a cigarette and looked at Arnie through the smoke. He had abandoned any pretense of good humor. His gaze was stony. Arnie clapped his hands to his head in an exaggerated gesture of exasperation. Autumn red, great. Christine's a custom job, but there were Fords from 1959 to 1963 painted autumn red, and Thunderbirds, and Chevrolet offered that shade from 1962 to 1964, and for a while in the mid-50s you could get a Rambler painted autumn red. I've been working on my 58 for half a year now. I get the car books. You can't do work on an old car without the books, or you're screwed before you start. Autumn red was a popular choice. I know it. He looked at Junkins fixedly. And you know it too, don't you? Junkins said nothing. He only went on looking at Arnie in that fixed, stony, unsettling way. Arnie had never been looked at in that way by anyone in his life, but he recognized the gaze. He supposed anyone would. It was a look of strong, frank suspicion. It scared him. A few months ago, even a few weeks ago, that was probably all it would have done. But now it made him furious as well. You're really reaching. Just what the hell have you got against me anyway, Mr. Junkins? Why are you on my ass? Junkins laughed and walked around in a large half circle. The place was entirely empty except for the two of them out here, and Will in his office, finishing his hoagie and licking olive oil off his hands and still watching them closely. What have I got against you? He said. How does first-degree murder sound to you, Arnie? Does that grab you with any force? Arnie grew very still. Don't worry, Junkins said, still walking. No big tough cop scene, no menacing threats about going downtown. Except in this case, downtown would be Harrisburg. No Miranda card. Everything is still fine for our hero, Arnold Cunningham. I don't understand any of what you're... You understand plenty, Junkins roared at him. He had stopped next to a giant yellow hulk of a truck, another of Johnny Pemberton's dumpsters in the making. He stared at Arnie. Three of the kids who beat on your car are dead. Autumn red paint samples were taken at both crime scenes, leading us to believe that the vehicle the perpetrator used in both cases was at least in part autumn red. And gee whiz, it just turns out that the car those kids trashed is mostly autumn red. And you stand there and push your glasses up on your nose and tell me you don't understand what I'm talking about. I was in Philadelphia when it happened, Arnie said quietly. Don't you get that? Don't you get that at all? Kiddo, Junkins said, flipping his cigarette away, that's the worst part of it. That's the part that really stinks. I wish you'd get out of here or put me under arrest or something, because I'm supposed to punch in and do some work. For now, Junkins said, talk is all I've got. The first time, when Welch got killed, you were supposed to be home in bed. Pretty thin, I know, Arnie said. Believe me, if I'd known this shit was going to come down on my head, I would have hired a sick friend to sit up with me.
Oh, no, that was good,
Junkin said. Your mother and father had no cause to doubt your tale. I could tell that from speaking to them. And alibis, the true ones, usually have more holes than a Salvation Army suit. It's when they start to look like suits of armor that I get nervous. Holy jumping Jesus, Arnie almost screamed. It was a fucking chess meet. I've been in the chess club for 4 years now. Until today, Junkin said. And Arnie grew still again. Junkins nodded. Oh, yeah, I talked to the club advisor, Herbert Slauson. He says that the first 3 years, you never missed a meeting. Even came to a couple with a low-grade case of the flu. You were his star player. Then this year, you were spotty right from the start. I had my car to work on, and I got a girl. He said you missed the first 3 tourneys, and he was pretty surprised when your name turned up on the trip sheet for the Northern States meet. He thought you'd lost all your interest in the club. I told you, yes, you did, too busy, cars and girls, just what makes most kids too busy. But you regained your interest long enough to go to Philly, and then you dropped out. That strikes me as very odd. I can't see anything funny about it, Arnie said, but his voice seemed distant, almost lost in the surf roar of blood in his ears. Bullshit. It looks as if you knew it was coming down and set yourself up with an airtight alibi. The roar in his head had even assumed the steady, wave-like beats of surf, each beat accompanied by a dull thrust of pain. He was getting a headache. Why wouldn't this monstrous man with his prying brown eyes just go away? None of it was true, none of it. He hadn't set anything up, not an alibi, not anything. He had been as surprised as anyone else when he read in the paper what had happened. Of course he had been. There was nothing strange going on, unless it was this lunatic's paranoia, and... How did you hurt your back, anyway, Arnie? And by the way, do you see anything green? Do you see... He closed his eyes, and for a moment the world seemed to lurch out of its orbit, and he saw that green, gritting, rotting face floating before him, saying, "Start her up. Get the heater going, and let's motivate. And while we're at it, let's get the shitters that wrecked our car. Let's grease the little cockknocker's kid, what do you say? Let's hit them so fucking hard the corpse cutter down at City Hospital will have to pull the paint chips out of their carcasses with pliers. What do you say? Find some doo-wop music on the radio, and let's cruise. Let's..." He groped back behind him, touched Christine, her hard, cool, reassuring surface, and things dropped back into place again. He opened his eyes. "There's only one other thing, really," Junkin said, "and it's very subjective. Nothing you could put on a report. You're different this time, Arnie. Harder, somehow. It's almost as if you've put on 20 years. Arnie laughed and was relieved to hear it sounded quite natural. "Mr. Junkins, you've got a screw loose." Junkins didn't join him in his laughter. "Uh-huh, I know it. The whole thing is screwy. Screwier than anything I've investigated in the 10 years I've been a detective. Last time I felt like I could reach you, Arnie. I felt you were, I don't know, lost, unhappy, groping around, trying to get out. Now I don't feel that at all. I almost feel like I'm talking to a different person. Not a very nice one." "I'm done talking to you," Arnie said abruptly, and began walking toward the office. "I want to know what happened," Junkins called after him, "and I'm going to find out. Believe me." "Do me a favor and stay away from here," Arnie said. "You're crazy." He let himself into the office, closed the door behind him, and noticed his hands weren't shaking at all. The room was stuffy with the smells of cigar and olive oil and garlic. He crossed in front of Will without speaking, took his time card out of the rack, and punched in, ka-thud. Then he looked through the glass window and saw Junkin standing there looking at Christine. Will said nothing. Arnie could hear the noisy engine of the big man's respiration. A couple of minutes later, Junkins left. "Cop," Will said, and ripped out a long belch. It sounded like a chainsaw. "Yeah. Ripperton?" "Yeah, he thinks I had something to do with it." "Even though you were in Philly?" Arnie shook his head. "He doesn't even seem to care about that." "He's a smart cop, then," Will thought.
He knows the facts are wrong, and his intuition tells him there's something even wronger than that, so he's gotten further with it than most cops ever would. But he could spend a million years and not get all the way to the truth. He thought of the empty car driving itself into stall 20 like some weird wind-up toy, the empty ignition slot turning over to start, the engine revving once like a warning snarl, and then falling off. And thinking of these things, Will did not trust himself to look Arnie in the face, even though his own experience in routine deceit was nearly lifelong. I don't want to send you to Albany if the cops are watching you. I don't care if you send me to Albany or not, but you don't have to worry about the heat. He's the only cop I've seen, and he's crazy. He's not interested in anything but two cases of hit and run. Now Will's eyes did meet Arnie's. Arnie's gray and distant. Will's a faded no color, the cornea's a dim yellow. They were the eyes of an ancient tomcat who has seen a thousand mice turned inside out. "He's interested in you," he said. "I'd better send Jimmy." "You like the way Jimmy drives, do you?" Will looked at Arnie for a moment and then sighed. "Okay," he said. "But if you see that cop, you back off. And if you get caught holding a bag, Cunningham, it's your bag. Do you understand that?" "Yes," Arnie said. "Do you want me to do some work tonight or what?" "There's a 77 Buick in 49. Pull the starter motor. Check the solenoid. If it seems okay, pull that too." Arnie nodded and left. Will's thoughtful eyes drifted from his retreating back to Christine. He had no business sending him to Albany this weekend, and he knew it. The kid knew it, too, but he was going to push ahead anyway. He had said he'd go, and he was now going to, by God, do it. And if anything happened, the kid would stand up. Will was sure of it. There was a time when he surely wouldn't have done, but that time was past now. He had heard it all on the intercom. Junkins had been right. The kid was harder now. Will began to look at the kid's 58 again. Arnie would be taking Will's Chrysler to New York. While he was gone, Will would watch Christine. He would watch Christine and see what happened. 40. Arnie in trouble. With Naga hide bucket seats in front and back, everything's chrome, man, even my jack. Step on the gas, she goes, "Wah, I'll let you look, but don't touch my custom machine." The Beach Boys. Rudolph Junkins and Rick Mercer of the Pennsylvania State Police Detective Division sat drinking coffee the following afternoon in a glum little office with paint peeling from the walls. Outside, a depressing mixture of snow and sleet was falling. "I'm pretty sure this is going to be the weekend," Junkins said. "That Chrysler has rolled every 4 or 5 weeks for the last 8 months." "Just understand that busting Darnell and whatever bee you've got in your bonnet about that kid are two different things." "They're both the same thing to me," Junkins replied. "The kid knows something. If I get him rattled, I may find out what it is." "You think he had an accomplice, someone who used his car and killed those kids while he was at the chess tourney?" Junkins shook his head. "No, goddammit, the kid has got exactly one good friend and he's in the hospital. I don't know what I think, except that the car was involved and he was involved too." Junkins put his styrofoam coffee cup down and pointed at the man on the other side of the desk. "Once we get that place closed down, I want a six-pack of lab technicians to go over it from stem to stern, inside and out. I want it up on a lift, I want it checked for dents, bumps, repaint, and for blood. That's what I really want, Rick, just one drop of blood." "You don't like that kid much, do you?" Rick asked. Junkins uttered a bewildered little laugh. "You know, the first time I kind of did. I liked him and I felt sorry for him. I felt like maybe he was covering for somebody else who had something on him. But this time, I didn't like him at all," he considered. "And I didn't like that car, either. The way he kept touching it every time I thought I had him on the ropes. It was spooky." Rick said, "As long as you remember that Darnell is the guy I've got to bust, no one in Harrisburg has the slightest interest in your kid." "I'll remember," Junkins said. He picked up his coffee again and looked at Rick grimly. "Because he's a means to the end. I'm going to nail the person who killed those kids, if it's the last thing I ever do." "It may not even go down this weekend," Rick said, "but it did." Two plainclothes cops from Pennsylvania's state felony squad sat in the cab of a 4-year-old Datsun pickup on the morning of Saturday, December 16th, watching as Will Darnell's black Chrysler rolled out of the big door and into the street. A light drizzle was falling. It was not quite cold enough to be sleet. It was one of those misty days when it is impossible to tell where the lowering clouds end and the actual mist begins. The Chrysler was quite properly showing its parking lights. Arnie Cunningham was a safe driver. One of the plainclothesmen lifted a walkie-talkie to his mouth and spoke into it. "He just came out in Darnell's car. You guys stay on your toes." They followed the Chrysler to I-76. When they saw Arnie get on the eastbound ramp with its Harrisburg sign, they turned up the westbound ramp toward Ohio and reported. They would get off I-76 one exit down the line and return to their original position near Darnell's garage. "Okay," Junkins's voice came back. "Let's make an omelet." 20 minutes later, as Arnie was cruising east at a sedate and legal 50, three cops with all the right paperwork in hand knocked on the door of William Upshaw, who lived in the very much upscale suburb of Sewickley. Upshaw answered the door in his bathrobe. From behind him came the cartoon squawks of Saturday morning TV. "Who is it, honey?" his wife called from the kitchen. Upshaw looked at the papers, which were court orders, and felt that he might faint. One ordered that all of Upshaw's tax records relating to Will Darnell, an individual, and Will Darnell, a corporation, be impounded. These papers bore the signature of the Pennsylvania Attorney General and a Superior Court judge. "Who is it, hon?" his wife asked again, and one of his kids came to look, all big eyes. Upshaw tried to speak and could raise only a dusty croak. It had come. He had dreamed about it, and it had finally come. The house in Sewickley had not protected him from it. The woman he kept at a safe distance in King of Prussia had not protected him from it. It was here. He read it in the smooth faces of these cops in their off-the-rack Anderson Little suits. Worst of all, one of them was federal, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. He produced a second ID, proclaiming him an agent of something called the Federal Drug Control Task Force. "Our information is that you keep an office in your home," the federal cop said. He looked, what, 26, 30? Had he ever had to worry about what you were going to do when you had three kids and a wife who liked nice things maybe a little too much? Bill Upshaw didn't think so. When you had those things to think about, your face didn't stay that smooth. Your face only stayed that smooth when you could indulge in the luxury of grand thoughts, law and order, right and wrong, good guys and bad guys. He opened his mouth to answer the federal cop's question and produced only another dusty croak. "Is this information correct?" the federal cop asked patiently. "Yes," Bill Upshaw croaked. "And another office at 100 Frankstown Road in Monroeville?" "Yes." "Hon, who is it?" Amber asked and came into the hallway. She saw the three men standing on the stoop and pulled the neck of her housecoat closed. The cartoons blared. Upshaw thought suddenly, almost with relief, "It's the end of everything." The kid who had come out to see who had come to visit so early on a Saturday morning suddenly burst into tears and fled for the safety of the Super Friends on Channel 4. When Rudy Junkins received the news that Upshaw had been served and that all the papers pertaining to Darnell, both at Upshaw's Sewickley home and his Monroeville office, had been impounded, he led half a dozen state cops in what he supposed would have been called a raid in the old days. Even during the holiday season, the garage was moderately busy on Saturday, although it was by no means the bustling place it became on summer weekends. And when Junkins raised a battery-powered loud hailer to his lips and began to use it, perhaps 2 dozen heads whipped around. They would have conversation enough out of this to last them into the new year. "This is the Pennsylvania State Police," Junkins cried into his loud hailer. The words echoed and bounced. He found, even at this instant, that his eyes were drawn to the white over red Plymouth sitting empty in stall 20. He had handled half a dozen murder weapons in his time, sometimes at the scene, more frequently in the witness box, but just looking at that car made him feel cold. Gitney, the IRS man who had come along for this particular sleigh ride, was frowning at him to go on. "None of you know what this is about, none of you." But he raised the loud hailer to his lips again. "This place of business is closed. I repeat, this place of business is closed. You may take your vehicles if they are in running order. If not, please leave quickly and quietly. This place is closed."
The loud hailer made an amplified click as he turned it off. He looked toward the office and saw that Will Darnell was talking on the telephone, an unlit cigar jammed in his face. Jimmy Sykes was standing by the Coke machine, his simple face a picture of confused dismay. He didn't look much different from Bill Upshaw's kid at the moment before he burst into tears. "Do you understand your rights as I have read them to you?" The cop in charge was Rick Mercer. Behind them, the garage was empty except for four uniformed cops who were doing paperwork on the cars which had been impounded when the garage was closed. "Yeah," Will said. His face was composed. The only sign of his upset was his deepening wheeze, the fast rise and fall of his big chest under his open-throated white shirt, the way he held his aspirator constantly in one hand. "Do you have anything to say to us at this time?" Mercer asked. "Not until my lawyer gets here." "Your lawyer can meet us in Harrisburg," Junkins said. Will glanced at Junkins contemptuously and said nothing. Outside, more uniformed police had finished affixing seals to every door and window of the garage, except for the small side door. Until the state of impound ceased, all traffic would use that door. "This is the craziest thing I ever heard of," Will Darnell said at last. "It'll get crazier," Mercer said, smiling sincerely. "You're going away for a very long time, Will. Maybe someday they'll put you in charge of the prison motor pool." "I know you," Will said, looking at him. "Your name is Mercer. I knew your father well. He was the crookedest cop that ever came out of Kings County." The blood fell out of Rick Mercer's face and he raised his hand. "Stop it, Rick," Junkins said. "Sure," Will said. "You guys have your fun. Make your jokes about the prison motor pool. I'll be back here doing business in 2 weeks. And if you don't know it, you're even stupider than you look." He glanced around at them, his eyes intelligent, sardonic, and trapped. Abruptly, he raised his aspirator to his mouth and breathed in deeply. "Get this bag of shit out of here," Mercer said. He was still white. "Are you all right?" Junkins asked. They were sitting in an unmarked state Ford half an hour later. The sun had decided to come out and shone blindingly on melting snow and wet streets. Darnell's garage sat silent. Darnell's records and Cunningham's street rod Plymouth were safely penned up inside. "That crack he made about my father," Mercer said heavily. "My father shot himself, Rudy, blew his head off. And I always thought, in college I read..." He shrugged. "Lots of cops eat the gun. Melvin Purvis did it, you know. He was the man who got Dillinger. But you wonder..." Mercer lit a cigarette and drew smoke downstairs in a long, shuddery breath. "He didn't know anything," Junkins said. "The fuck he didn't," Mercer said. He unrolled his window and threw the cigarette out. He unclipped the mic under the dash. "Home, this is Mobile 2. 10-4, Mobile 2. What's happening with our carrier pigeon?" "He's on Interstate 84, coming up on Port Jervis." Port Jervis was the crossover point between Pennsylvania and New York. "New York is all ready?" "Affirmative." "You tell him again that I want him northeast of Middletown before they grab him, and his toll ticket taken in evidence." 10-4. Mercer put the mic back and smiled thinly. "Once he crosses into New York, there's not a question in the world about it being federal. But we've still got first dibs. Isn't that beautiful?" Junkins didn't answer. There was nothing beautiful about it. From Darnell with his aspirator to Mercer's father eating his gun, there was nothing beautiful about it. Junkins was filled with a spooky feeling of inevitability, a feeling that the ugly things were not ending, but only just beginning to happen. He felt halfway through a dark story that might prove too terrible to finish. Except he had to finish it now, didn't he? Yes. The terrible feeling, the terrible image, persisted. That the first time he had talked to Arnie Cunningham, he had been talking to a drowning man. And the second time he had talked to him, the drowning had happened, and he was talking to a corpse. The cloud cover over western New York was breaking, and Arnie's spirits began to rise. It always felt good to get away from Libertyville, away from everything. Not even the knowledge that he had contraband in the trunk could quench that feeling of lift. And at least it wasn't dope this time. Far in the back of his mind, hardly even acknowledged, but there, was the idle speculation about how things would be different and how his life would change if he just dumped the cigarettes and kept on going. If he just left the entire depressing mess behind. But, of course, he wouldn't. Leaving Christine after he had put so much into her was, of course, impossible. He turned up the radio and hummed along with something current. The sun, weakened by December but still trying to be bold, broke cover entirely, and Arnie grinned. He was still grinning when the New York State police car pulled up beside him in the passing lane and paced him. The loudspeaker on top began to chant, "This is for the Chrysler. Pull over, Chrysler. Pull over." Arnie looked over, the grin fading from his lips. He stared into a pair of black sunglasses, cop glasses. The terror that seized him was deeper than he would have believed any emotion could be. And it wasn't for himself. His mouth went totally dry. His mind went into a blurring overdrive. He saw himself tramping the gas pedal and running for it. And perhaps he would have done it if he had been driving Christine, but he wasn't. He saw Will Darnell telling him that if he got caught holding a bag, it was his bag. Most of all, he saw Junkins. Junkins with his sharp brown eyes, and knew this was Junkins's doing. He wished Rudolph Junkins was dead. "Pull over, Chrysler. I'm not talking to hear my own voice. Pull over right now." "Can't say anything," Arnie thought incoherently as he veered over into the breakdown lane. His balls were crawling, his stomach churning madly. He could see his own eyes in the rear view, wall-eyed with fear behind his glasses. Not for him, though. Not for him. Christine. He was afraid for Christine. What they might do to Christine. His panic-stricken mind spun up a kaleidoscope of jumbled images. College application forms with the words, "Rejected, convicted felon," stamped across them. Prison bars, blued steel. A judge bending down from a high bench, his face white and accusing. Big bull queers in a prison yard looking for fresh meat. Christine riding the conveyor into the car crusher in the junkyard behind the garage. And then, as he stopped the Chrysler and put it in park, the state police car pulling in behind him, and another appearing like magic pulling in ahead of him. A thought came from nowhere, full of cold comfort. Christine can take care of herself. Another thought came as the cops got out and came toward him, one holding a search warrant in his hand. It also seemed to come from nowhere, but it reverberated in Roland D. LeBay's raspy old man's tones. "And she'll take care of you, boy. All you got to do is go on believing in her, and she'll take care of you." Arnie opened the car door and got out a moment before one of the cops could open it. "Arnold Richard Cunningham?" one of the cops asked. "Yes, indeed," Arnie said calmly. "Was I speeding?" "No, son," one of the others said. "But you are in a world of hurt all the same." The first cop stepped forward as formally as a career Army officer. "I have a duly executed document here permitting the search of this 1966 Chrysler Imperial in the name of the people of New York State and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and of the United States of America. Further..." "Well, that just about covers the motherfucking waterfront, doesn't it?" Arnie said. His back flared dully, and he jammed his hands against it. The cop's eyes widened slightly at the old voice coming out of this kid, but then he went on. "Further, to seize any contraband found in the course of this search in the name of the people of New York State and of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and of the United States of America." "Fine," Arnie said. None of it seemed real. Blue lights flashed to confusion. People passing in their cars turned to look, but he found he had no desire to turn from them, to hide his face, and that was something of a relief. "Give me the keys, kid," one of the cops said. "Why don't you just get them yourself, you shitter?" Arnie said. "You're not helping yourself, kiddo," the cop said, but he looked startled and a little fearful all the same. For a moment, the kid's voice had deepened and roughened, and he had sounded 40 years older and a pretty tough customer. Nothing like the skinny kid he saw before him at all. He leaned in, got the keys, and three of the cops immediately headed for the trunk. "They know," Arnie thought, resigned. At least this had nothing to do with Junkins's obsession with Buddy Repperton and Moochie Welch and the others, at least not directly, he amended cautiously. This smelled like a well-planned and well-coordinated operation against Will's smuggling operations from Libertyville into New York and New England. "Kid," one of the cops said, Would you like to answer some questions or make a statement? If you think you would, I'll read you the Miranda right now.
No, Arnie said calmly.
I don't have anything to say. Things could go a lot easier with you. That's coercion, Arnie said, smiling a little. Watch out or you'll put a big fat hole in your own case. The cop flushed. If you want to be an asshole, that's your lookout. The Chrysler trunk was open. He had pulled out the spare tire, the jack, and several boxes of small parts, springs, nuts, bolts, and the like. One of the cops was almost entirely in the trunk. Only his blue-gray clad legs stuck out. For a moment, Arnie hoped vaguely that they wouldn't find the under-compartment. Then he dismissed the thought. It was just the childish part of him, the part he now wished burned away, because all that part of him did lately was hurt. They would find it. The quicker they found it, the quicker this nasty roadside scene would end. As if some god had heard his wish and decided to grant it post-haste, the cop in the trunk called triumphantly, "Cigarettes!" "All right," the cop who had read the warrant said. "Close it up." He turned to Arnie and read him the Miranda warning. "Do you understand your rights as I've read them to you?" "Yes," Arnie said. "Do you want to make a statement?" "No." "Get in the car, son. You're under arrest." I'm under arrest, Arnie thought, and almost brayed laughter. The thought was so foolish. This was all a dream, and he would wake up soon. Under arrest. Being hustled to a state police cruiser, people looking at him. Desperate, childish tears, hot salt, welled up in his throat and closed it. His chest hitched once, twice. The cop who had read him his rights touched his shoulder, and Arnie shrugged it off with a kind of desperation. He felt that if he could get deep down inside himself quickly enough, he would be okay, but sympathy might drive him mad. "Don't touch me." "You do it the way you want to do it, son," the cop said, removing his hand. He opened the cruiser's rear door for Arnie and handed him in. Do you cry in dreams? Of course you could. Hadn't he read about people waking up from sad dreams with tears on their cheeks? But dream or no dream, he wasn't going to cry. Instead, he would think of Christine, not of his mother, her father, not of Lee or Will Darnell, not of Slauson, all the miserable shitters who had betrayed him. He would think of Christine. Arnie closed his eyes and leaned his pale, gaunt face forward into his hands, and did just that. And as always, thinking about Christine made things better. After a while, he was able to straighten up and look out at the passing scenery and think about his position. Michael Cunningham put the telephone back into its cradle slowly, with infinite care. As if to do less might cause it to explode and spray his upstairs study with jagged black hooks of shrapnel. He sat back in the swivel chair behind his desk, on which there sat his IBM correcting Selectric II typewriter, an ashtray with the blue and gold legend Horlicks University, barely legible across the dirty bottom, and the manuscript of his third book, a study of the ironclads Monitor and Merrimack. He had been halfway through a page when the telephone rang. Now he flipped the paper release on the right side of the typewriter and pulled the page bonelessly out from under the roller, observing its slight curve clinically. He put it down on top of the manuscript, which was now a little more than a jungle of penciled-in corrections. Outside, a cold wind whined around the house. The morning's cloudy warmth had given way to a frigid, clear December evening. The earlier melt had frozen tight, and his son was being held in Albany on charges of what amounted to smuggling. "No, Mr. Cunningham, it is not marijuana. It is cigarettes, 200 cartons of Winston cigarettes with no tax stamps." From downstairs, he could hear the whir of Regina's sewing machine. He would have to get up now, go to the door and open it, go down the hall to the stairs, walk down the stairs, walk into the dining room, then into the plant-lined little room that had once been a laundry but which was now a sewing room, and stand there while Regina looked up at him. She would be wearing her half-glasses for the close work, and say, "Regina, Arnie has been arrested by the New York State Police." Michael attempted to begin this process by getting up from his desk chair, but the chair seemed to sense he was temporarily off guard. It swiveled and rolled backward on its casters at the same moment, and Michael had to clutch the edge of his desk to keep from falling. He slipped heavily back into the chair, heart thudding with painful rapidity in his chest. He was struck suddenly by such a complex wave of despair and sorrow that he groaned aloud and grabbed his forehead, squeezing his temples.
The old thoughts swarmed back in, as predictable as summer mosquitoes and just as maddening. 6 months ago, things had been okay. Now his son was sitting in a jail cell somewhere. What were the watershed moments? How could he, Michael, have changed things? What was the history of it exactly? Where had the sickness started to creep in? Jesus. He squeezed harder, listening to the winter whine outside the windows. He and Arnie had put the storms on just last month. That had been a good day, hadn't it? First Arnie holding the ladder and looking up, then him down and Arnie up there, him shouting for Arnie to be careful, the wind in his hair and dead brown leaves blowing over his shoes, their colors gone. Sure, it had been a good day. Even after that beastly car had come, seeming to overshadow everything in their son's life like a fatal disease, there had been some good days, hadn't there? Jesus, he said again in a weak, teary voice that he despised. Unbidden images rose behind his eyes. Colleagues looking at him sideways, maybe whispering in the faculty club. Discussions at cocktail parties in which his name bobbed uneasily up and down like a waterlogged body. Arnie wouldn't be 18 for almost 2 months, and he supposed that meant his name couldn't be printed in the paper, but everyone would still know, word got around. Suddenly, crazily, he saw Arnie at 4, astride a red trike he and Regina had gotten at a rummage sale. Arnie at 4 had called them Mama's Rubbage Sales. The trike's red paint was flaked with scales of rust, the tires were bald, but Arnie had loved it. He would have taken that trike to bed with him if he could. Michael closed his eyes and saw Arnie riding up and down the sidewalk, wearing his blue corduroy jumper, his hair flopping in his eyes. And then his mind's eye blinked or wavered or did something, and the rusty rubbish sale trike was Christine, her red paint scummed with rust, her windows milky white with age. He gritted his teeth together. Someone looking in might have thought he was smiling crazily. He waited until he had some kind of control, and then he got up and went downstairs to tell Regina what had happened. He would tell her, and she would think of what they were going to do, just as she always had. She would steal the forward motion from him, taking whatever sorry bomb that actually doing things had to give, and leave him with only sick sorrow and the knowledge that now his son was someone else. 41. The Coming of the Storm. She took the keys to my Cadillac car, jumped in my kitty, and drove her far. Bob Seger. The first of that winter's great northeast storms came to Libertyville on Christmas Eve, beating its way across the upper third of the U.S. on a wide and easily predictable storm track. The day began in bright 30-degree sunshine, but morning DJs were already cheerfully predicting doom and gloom, urging those who had not finished their last-minute shopping to do so by mid-afternoon. Those planning trips to the old homestead for an old-fashioned Christmas were urged to rethink their plans if the trip could not be made in 4 to 6 hours. If you don't want to be spending Christmas Day in the breakdown lane of I-76, somewhere between Bedford and Carlisle, I'd leave early or not at all, the FM 104 jock advised his listening audience, a large part of which was too stoned to even consider going anyplace, and then resumed the Christmas block party with Springsteen's version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town. By 11 a.m., when Dennis Gilder finally left Libertyville Community Hospital, as per hospital regulations, he was not allowed on his crutches until he was actually out of the building. Until then, he was pushed along in a wheelchair by Elaine. The sky had begun to scum over with clouds, and there was an eerie fairy ring around the sun. Dennis crossed the parking lot carefully on his crutches, his mother and father bookending him nervously, in spite of the fact that the lot had been scrupulously salted, free of even the slightest trace of snow and ice. He paused by the family car, turning his face up slightly into the freshening breeze. Being outside was like a resurrection. He felt he could stand here for hours and not have enough of it. By 1 o'clock that afternoon, the Cunningham family station wagon had reached the outskirts of Ligonier, 90 miles east of Libertyville. The sky had gone a smooth and pregnant slate gray by this time, and the temperature had dropped 6 degrees. It had been Arnie's idea that they not cancel the traditional Christmas Eve visit with Aunt Vicky and Uncle Steve, Regina's sister and her husband. The two families had created a casual, loosely rotating ritual over the years, With Vicky and Steve coming to their house some years, the Cunninghams going over to Ligonier on others. This year's trip had been arranged in early December. It had been canceled after what Regina stubbornly called Arnie's trouble, but at the beginning of last week, Arnie had begun restlessly agitating for the trip. At last, after a long telephone conversation with her sister on Wednesday, Regina gave in to Arnie's wish, mostly because Vicky had seemed calm and understanding, and most of all not very curious about what had happened. That was important to Regina, more important than she would perhaps ever be able to say. It seemed to her that in the 8 days since Arnie had been arrested in New York, she had had to cope with a seemingly endless flood of rancid curiosity masquerading as sympathy. Talking to Vicky on the telephone, she had finally broken down and cried. It was the first and only time since Arnie had been arrested in New York that she had allowed herself that bitter luxury. Arnie had been in bed asleep. Michael, who was drinking much too much and passing it off as the spirit of the season, had gone down to O'Malley's for a beer or two with Paul Strickland, another factory reject in the game of faculty politics. It would probably end up being 6 beers, or 8, or 10. And if she went upstairs to his study later on, she would find him sitting bolt upright behind his desk, looking out into the dark, his eyes dry but bloodshot. If she tried to speak with him, his conversation would be horribly confused and centered too much in the past. She supposed her husband might be having a very quiet mental breakdown. She would not allow herself the same luxury, for so, in her own hurt and angry state, she thought it. And every night her mind ticked and whirred with plans and schemes until 3 or 4 o'clock. All these thoughts and schemes were aimed at one end, getting us over this. The only 2 ways she would allow her mind to approach what had happened were deliberately vague. She thought about Arnie's trouble and getting us over this. But talking to Vicky on the phone a few days after her son's arrest, Regina's iron control had wavered briefly. She cried on Vicky's shoulder long distance, and Vicky had been calmly comforting, making Regina hate herself for all the cheap shots she had taken at Vicky over the years. Vicky, whose only daughter had dropped out of junior college to get married and become a housewife, whose only son had been content with a vocational technical school. None of that for her son, Regina had thought with a private exultation. Vicky, whose husband sold, of all hilarious things, life insurance. And Vicky, hilariouser and hilariouser, sold Tupperware. But it was Vicky she had been able to cry to. It had been Vicky to whom she had been able to express at least part of her tortured sense of disappointment and terror and hurt. Yes, and the terrible embarrassment of it, of knowing that people were talking, and that people who had for years wanted to see her take a fall were now satisfied. It was Vicky. Maybe it had always been Vicky. And Regina decided that if there was to be a Christmas at all for them, this miserable year, it would be at Vicky and Steve's ordinary suburban ranch house in the amusingly middle-class suburb of Ligonier, where most people still owned American cars and called a trip to McDonald's eating out. Mike, of course, simply went along with her decision. She would have expected no more and brooked no less. For Regina Cunningham, the 3 days following the news that Arnie was in trouble had been an exercise in pure, cold control, a hard lunge for survival. Her survival, the family's survival, Arnie's survival. He might not believe that, but Regina found she hadn't the time to care. Mike's pain had never entered her equations. The thought that they could comfort each other had never even crossed her mind as a speculation. She had calmly put the cover on her sewing machine after Mike came downstairs and gave her the news. She did that, and then she had gone to the phone and had gotten to work. The tears she would later shed while talking to her sister had then been 1,000 years away. She had brushed past Michael as if he were a piece of the furniture, and he had trailed uncertainly after her, as he had done all of their married life. She called Tom Sprague, their lawyer, who, hearing that their problem was criminal, hastily referred her to a colleague, Jim Warburg. She called Warburg and got an answering service that would not reveal Warburg's home number. She sat by the phone for a moment, drumming her fingers lightly against her lips, and then called their family lawyer back. Sprague hadn't wanted to give her Warburg's home telephone number, but in the end he gave in. When Regina finally let him go, Sprague sounded dazed, almost shell-shocked. Regina, in full spate, often caused such a reaction. She called Warburg, who said he absolutely couldn't take the case. Regina had lowered her bulldozer blade again. Warburg ended up not only taking the case, but agreeing to go immediately to Albany, where Arnie was being held, to see what could be done. Warburg, speaking in the weak, amazed voice of a man who has been filled full of Novocaine and then run over by a tractor, protested that he knew a perfectly good man in Albany who could get the lay of the land. Regina was adamant. Warburg went by private plane and reported back 4 hours later. Arnie, he said, was being held on an open charge. He would be extradited to Pennsylvania the following day. Pennsylvania and New York had coordinated the bust along with three federal agencies, the Federal Drug Control Task Force, the IRS, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The main target was not Arnie, who was small beans, but Will Darnell. Darnell and whomever Darnell was doing business with. Those guys, Warburg said, with their suspected ties to organized crime and disorganized drug smuggling in the New South, were the big beans. Holding someone on an open charge is illegal, Regina had snapped immediately, drawing on a deep backlog of TV crime show fare. Warburg, not exactly overjoyed to be where he was when he had planned on spending a quiet evening at home reading a book, rejoined crisply, I'd be down on my knees thanking God that's what they're doing. They caught him with a trunkload of unstamped cigarettes, and if I push them on it, they'll be more than happy to charge him, Mrs. Cunningham. I advise you and your husband to get over here to Albany, quickly. I thought you said he was going to be extradited tomorrow. Oh, yes, that's all been arranged. If we've got to play hardball with these guys, we ought to be glad the game's going to be played on our home court. Extradition isn't the problem here. What is? These people want to play knock over the dominoes. They want to knock your son over onto Will Darnell. Arnold is not talking. I want you two to get over here and persuade him that it's in his best interest to talk. Is it? She had asked hesitantly. Hell yes, Warburg's voice crackled back. These guys don't want to put your son in jail. He's a minor from a good family with no previous criminal record, not even a school record of disciplinary problems. He can get out of this without even facing a judge, but he's got to talk. So they had gone to Albany, and Regina had been taken down a short, narrow hallway, faced in white tile, lit with high-intensity bulbs sunken into small wells in the ceiling and covered with wire mesh. The place had smelled vaguely of Lysol and urine, and she kept trying to convince herself that her son was being held here, her son. But achieving that conviction was a hard go. It didn't seem possible that it could be true. The possibility that it was all a hallucination seemed much more likely. Seeing Arnie had stripped away that possibility in a hurry. The protective jacket of shock was likewise stripped away, and she felt a cold, consuming fear. It was at this moment that she had first seized on the idea of getting us over this, the way a drowning person will seize a life preserver. It was Arnie. It was her son. Not in a jail cell. That was the only thing she had been spared, but she was grateful for even small favors. But in a small square room, whose only furnishings were two chairs and a table scarred with cigarette burns. Arnie had looked at her steadily, and his face seemed horribly gaunt, skull-like. He had been to the barber only a week before, and had gotten a surprisingly short haircut, after years of wearing it long, in emulation of Demis. And now the overhead light shone down cruelly through what was left, making him appear momentarily bald, as if they had shaved his head to loosen his lips. Arnie, she said, and went to him, halfway to him. He turned his head away from her, his lips pressing together, and she stopped. A lesser woman might have burst into tears then, but Regina was not a lesser woman. She let the coldness come back and have its way with her. The coldness was all that would help now. Instead of embracing him, something he obviously didn't want, she sat down and told him what had to be done. He refused. She ordered him to talk to the police. He refused again. She reasoned with him. He refused. She harangued him. He refused. She pleaded with him. He refused. Finally, she just sat there dully, a headache thudding at her temples, and asked him why. He refused to tell her. I thought you were smart, she shouted finally. She was nearly mad with frustration. The thing she hated above all others was not getting her way when she absolutely wanted to have it, needed to have it. This had, in fact, never happened to her since she left home. Until now. It was infuriating to be so smoothly and seamlessly balked by this boy who had once drawn milk from her breasts. I thought you were smart, but you're stupid. You're an asshole. They'll put you in jail. Do you want to go to jail for that man Darnell? Is that what you want? He'll laugh at you. He'll laugh at you. Regina could imagine nothing worse, and her son's apparent lack of interest in whether or not he was laughed at infuriated her all the more. She rose from her chair and pushed her hair away from her brow and eyes, the unconscious gesture of a person who is ready to fight. She was breathing rapidly, and her face was flushed. To Arnie, she looked both younger and much, much older than he had ever seen her. "I'm not doing it for Darnell," he said quietly, "and I'm not going to jail." "What are you, Oliver Wendell Holmes?" she rejoined fiercely, but her anger was in some measure overmastered by relief. At least he could say something. "They caught you in his car with the trunk loaded with cigarettes, illegal cigarettes." Mildly, Arnie said, "They weren't in the trunk. They were in a compartment under the trunk, a secret compartment. And it was Will's car. Will told me to take his car." She looked at him. "Are you saying you didn't know they were there?" Arnie looked at her with an expression she simply couldn't accept. It was so foreign to his face. It was contempt. "Good as gold. My boy's as good as gold," she thought crazily. "I knew, and Will knew, but they have to prove it, don't they?" She could only look at him, amazed. "If they do drop it on me somehow," he said, "I'll get a suspended sentence." "Arnie," she said at last, "you're not thinking straight. Maybe your father..." "Yes," he interrupted, "I'm thinking straight. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm thinking very straight." And he looked at her, his gray eyes so horribly blank that she could no longer stand it and had to leave. In the small green reception room, she walked blindly past her husband, who had been sitting on a bench with Warburg. "You go in," she said. "You make him see reason." She went on without waiting for his reply, not stopping until she was outside and the cold December air was painting her hot cheeks. Michael went in and had no better luck. He came out with nothing more than a dry throat and a face that looked 10 years older than it had going in. At the motel, Regina told Warburg what Arnie had said and asked him if there was any chance he might be right. Warburg looked thoughtful. "Yes, that's a possible defense," he said. "But it would be a hell of a lot more possible if Arnie was the first domino in line. He's not. There's a used car dealer here in Albany named Henry Buck. He was the catcher. He's been arrested, too." "What has he said?" Michael asked. "I have no way of knowing. But when I tried to speak to his lawyer, he declined to speak with me. I find that ominous. If Buck talks, he puts the onus on Arnie. I'll bet you my house and lot that Buck can testify your son knew that secret compartment was there. And that's bad." Warburg looked at them closely. "You see, what your boy said to you is really only half smart, Mrs. Cunningham. I'll be talking to him tomorrow before they move him back to Pennsylvania. What I hope to make him see is that there's a possibility this whole thing could come down on his head." The first flakes of snow began to swirl out of the heavy sky as they turned onto Steve and Vicky's street. "Is it snowing in Libertyville yet?" Arnie wondered, and touched the keys on their leather tab in his pocket. Probably it was. Christine was still in Darnell's garage, impounded. That was all right. At least she was out of the weather. He would pick her up again, in time. The previous weekend was like a blurred, bad dream. His parents, haranguing him in the little white room, had seemed to bear the disconnected faces of strangers. They were heads talking in a foreign language. The lawyer they had hired, Worley or Warmley or whatever, kept talking about something he called the domino theory, and about the need to get out of the condemned building before the whole thing falls down on your head, boy. There are 2 states and 3 federal agencies bringing up the wrecking balls. But Arnie was more worried about Christine. It seemed clearer and clearer to him that Roland D. LeBay was either with him or hovering someplace near. He was, perhaps, coalescing inside him. This idea did not frighten Arnie. It comforted him. But he had to be careful. Not of Junkins. He felt that Junkins had only suspicions, and that they all lay in wrong directions, radiating out from Christine rather than in toward her. But Darnell, there could be problems with Will. Yes, real problems. That first night in Albany, after his mother and father had gone back to their motel, Arnie had been conducted to a holding cell, where he had fallen asleep with surprising ease and speed. and he had had a dream. Not quite a nightmare, but something that seemed terribly disquieting. He had awakened watchfully in the middle of the night, his body running with sweat. He had dreamed that Christine had been reduced in scale to a tiny 58 Plymouth, no longer than a man's hand. It was on a slot car track surrounded by HO-scale scenery that was amazingly apt. Here was a plastic street that could be Basin Drive. Here was another that could be JFK Drive, where Moochie Welch had been killed. A Lego building that looked exactly like Libertyville High. Plastic houses, paper trees. And a gigantic, hulking Will Darnell was at the controls that dictated how fast or how slowly the tiny Fury ran through all of this. His breath wheezed in and out of his damaged lungs with a windstorm sound. "You don't want to open your mouth, kiddo," Will said. He loomed over this scale model world like the amazing colossal man. "You don't want to frig with me because I'm in control. I can do this." And slowly Will began to turn the control knob over toward fast. "No!" Arnie tried to scream. "No, don't do that! Please, I love her! Please, you'll kill her!" On the track, the tiny Christine raced through the tiny Libertyville faster and faster, her rear end switching on the curves as she shimmied on the far edge of centrifugal force, that dish-shaped mystery. Now she was simply a blur of white over red, her engine a high, angry wasp whine. "Please!" Arnie screamed. "Please!" At last, Will had begun to turn the control back. Looking grimly pleased, the little car began to slow down. "If you start to get ideas, you just want to remember where your car is, kiddo. Keep your mouth shut and we'll both live to fight another day. I've been in tighter jams than this." Arnie had reached out to grasp the little car to rescue it from the track. The dream Will had slapped his hand away. "Whose bag is it, kiddo?"
"Will, please."
"Let me hear you say it."
"It's my bag."
"Just remember it, kiddo." And Arnie had awakened with that in his ears. There had been no more sleep for him that night. Was it so unlikely that Will would know, well, would know something about Christine? No. He saw a great deal from behind that window, but he knew how to keep his mouth shut, at least until the time was right to open it. He might know what Junkins did not, that Christine's regeneration in November was not just strange, but totally impossible. He would know that a lot of the repairs had never been made, at least not by Arnie. What else would he know? With a creeping coldness that moved up his legs to the root of his guts, Arnie realized at last that Will could have been at the garage the night Repperton and the others had died. In fact, it was more than possible, it was probable. Jimmy Sykes was simple, and Will didn't like to trust him alone. "You don't want to open your mouth. You don't want to frig with me because I can do this." But even supposing Will knew, who would believe him? It was too late for self-delusion now, and Arnie could no longer put the unthinkable thought away from himself. He no longer even wanted to. Who would believe Will if Will decided to tell someone that Christine sometimes ran by herself? That she had been out on her own the night Moochie Welch was killed, and the night those other hoods were killed? Would the police believe that? They would laugh themselves into a hemorrhage. Junkins? Getting warmer. But Arnie didn't believe Junkins would be able to accept such a thing, even if he wanted to. Arnie had seen his eyes. So even if Will did know, what good would his knowledge do? Then, with mounting horror, Arnie realized that it didn't matter. Will would be out on bail tomorrow or the next day. And then Christine would be his hostage. He could torch it. He had torched plenty of cars in his time, as Arnie knew from sitting in the office and listening to him yarn. And after she was torched, a burned hulk, helpless, there was the crusher out back. In goes the cindered hulk of Christine on the conveyor belt. Out comes a smashed cube of metal. The cops have sealed the place. But that didn't cut any ice either. Will Darnell was a very old fox, and he stayed prepared for any contingency. If Will wanted to get in and torch Christine, he would do it. Although it was much more likely, Arnie thought, that he would hire an insurance specialist to do the job. A guy who would throw double handfuls of charcoal lighter cubes into the car and then toss a match. In his mind's eye, Arnie could see the blossoming flames. He could smell charring upholstery. He lay on the cell bunk, his mouth dry, his heart beating rapidly in his chest. "You don't want to open your mouth. You don't want to frig with me." Of course, if Will tried something and got careless, if his concentration lapsed for even a moment, Christine would get him. But somehow, Arnie didn't think Will would get careless. The next day, he had been taken back to Pennsylvania, charged, then bailed for a nominal sum. There would be a preliminary hearing in January, and there was already talk of a grand jury. The bust was front-page material across the state, although Arnie was only identified as a youth whose name was being withheld by state and federal authorities due to his minor status. Arnie's name was common enough knowledge in Libertyville, however. In spite of its new exurban sprawl of drive-ins, fast-food emporiums, and bowl-a-ramas, it was still a faculty town where a lot of people were living in other people's back pockets. These people, mostly associated with Horlicks University, knew who had been driving for Will Darnell and who had been arrested over the New York state line with a trunk full of contraband cigarettes. It was Regina's nightmare. Arnie went home in the custody of his parents, bailed for $1,000, after a brief detour to jail. It was all nothing but a big shitting game of Monopoly, really. His parents had come up with the get-out-of-jail-free card, as expected. "What are you smiling about, Arnie?" Regina asked him. Michael was driving the wagon along at fast walking speed, looking through the swirls of snow for Steve and Vicky's ranch house. "Was I smiling?" "Yes," she said, and touched his hair. "I don't really remember," he said remotely, and she took her hand away. He had come home on Sunday, and his parents had left him pretty much alone, either because they didn't know how to talk to him or because they were utterly disgusted with him. Or perhaps it was a combination of the two. He didn't give a crap which, and that was the truth. He felt washed out, exhausted, a ghost of himself. His mother had gone to bed and slept all that afternoon, after taking the telephone off the hook. His father puttered aimlessly in his workroom, running his electric planer periodically, and then shutting it off. Arnie sat in the living room watching a football playoff doubleheader, not knowing who was playing, not caring, content to watch the players run around, first in bright, warm California sunshine, later in a mixture of rain and sleet that turned the playing field to churned up mud and erased the lines. Around 6 o'clock, he dozed off and dreamed. He dreamed again that night and the next, in the bed where he had slept since earliest childhood, the elm outside casting its old familiar shadow, a skeleton each winter that gained miraculous new flesh each May. These dreams were not like the dream of the giant Will looming over the slot car track. He could not remember these dreams at all more than a few moments after waking. Perhaps that was just as well. A figure by the roadside, a fleshless finger tapping a decayed palm in a lunatic parody of instruction, an uneasy sense of freedom and escape? Yes, escape, nothing else except... Yes, he escaped from these dreams and back into reality with one repeating image. He was behind the wheel of Christine, driving slowly through a howling blizzard, snow so thick that he could literally see no farther than the end of her hood. The wind was not a scream, it was a lower, more sinister sound, a basso roar. Then the image had changed. The snow wasn't snow any longer, it was ticker tape. The roar of the wind was the roar of a great crowd lining both sides of Fifth Avenue. They were cheering him. They were cheering Christine. They were cheering because he and Christine had escaped. Each time this confused dream retreated, he thought, when this is over, I'm getting out for sure, going to drive to Mexico. And Mexico, as he imagined its steady sun and its rural quiet, seemed more real than the dreams. Shortly after awakening from the last of these dreams, the idea of spending Christmas with Aunt Vicky and Uncle Steve, just like in the old days, had come to him. He awoke with it, and it clanged in his head with a peculiar persistence. The idea seemed to be an awfully good one, an all-important one. To get out of Libertyville before... well, before Christmas, what else? So he began talking to his mother and father about it, coming down particularly hard on Regina. On Wednesday, she abruptly gave in and agreed. He knew she had talked to Vicky, and Vicky hadn't been inclined to lord it over her, so it was all right. Now, on Christmas Eve, he felt that everything would soon be all right. "There it is, Mike," Regina said. "And you're going to drive right by it, just like you do every time we come here." Michael grunted and turned into the driveway. "I saw it," he said, in the perpetually defensive tone he always seemed to use around his wife. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.